the ransom for many remind you of Isaiah, don't they? And I think they, for me, they confirm the ideas in Jesus' mind, very much influenced by Isaiah. So this passage comes just after Jesus has told his disciples for the third time about what's going to happen when he gets to Jerusalem. You know, the three times in Mark. First time was when he first stops them on the road and says that he's going to die. And their reaction is to try and stop him. You know, Peter says, no, this can't happen, you've got it wrong. So not the right response. The second time, instead of reacting properly, they are really sort of questioning what's going to happen. They start arguing amongst themselves as to which is the greatest. So they don't excel themselves then. And this is the third time, much more serious, because they're getting close to Jerusalem now, physically and time-wise. And what do? They start asking if they can sit on his left and right in his glory, sort of totally ignore the adversity to come and concentrate on glory. The same story appears in Matthew chapter 20, and there's an interesting addition that it isn't actually James and John that make the request, but their mother, Salome, who is Jesus' aunt, actually the sister of Mary, asking on their behalf. And was she trying to get one up on Peter to get them in the prime places? Or were they trying to take a shortcut to the glory without the adversity on the way? Because they knew Jesus had spoken about the glory to come, but they didn't really appreciate how. They misunderstood glory as a reward, again, earned by service and sacrifice, rather than something achieved through the process of overcoming adversity. And how would that be achieved? By alignment with God's will. So Jesus says, you don't understand what you're asking. Can you drink the cup that I'm going to drink? Which in those days meant, can you suffer in the way that I'm going to suffer? Can you go through my experience? And they say, yes, we can. And he says, yes, you can, you're right, and you will. And he then says, can you be baptized with the baptism I'm going to be baptized with? Well, he'd already been baptized. It wasn't baptism he was talking about. It was immersion in sorrow and sadness, a man of sorrows. And again they said yes, and again he said yes, well, you will. You're good. And they would. But as for sitting on his left and right, it's metaphorical, but what he was saying was, it's not for me to grant, because it's not up to me, it's up to you. It depends on your behavior. If you're true to the calling, if you are true to the adversity and don't shy away from it, then you might indeed be regarded as first and second amongst the disciples. But if you aren't, that won't happen. So Jesus, well, not surprisingly, the rest of the disciples are a bit miffed that two of them are trying to get one up on them and get the best seats at the table. So to quell the argument straight away, Jesus puts them all in perspective, sits them down and says, look, if you really want to be first, you'll have to be last. If you really want to lead this group, you'll have to serve them, just as he did with the towel and the basin in the upper room. And in verse 45, he says, even the Son of Man didn't come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. And that's a key verse which has been focused on ever since in our faith. So how does it relate to us today? Well, we might feel overburdened with our roles of service. Most of you here, as I look at you, are servants in one way or another, sometimes in many ways, and perhaps feeling the pressure of service more and more, not just in church, I hasten to add, but outside these walls, with more pressure, more demand, less help sometimes, all of us getting older, and not always the most helpful surroundings. And we can all feel exposed or lonely or unqualified to shoulder those burdens. But we can all take heart from the assurance of our Lord, because, as I said earlier, he did give us an example of how to overcome violence, injustice, loneliness, being left alone, deserted by all his followers, not giving in to the temptation to want to return bad with bad, but to overcome it with good. So for me, this idea of Christ dying for us, it does still work. A member of our family was feeling very stressed through her work, and we were quite worried about her. And then one of her colleagues threw themselves in front of a train. And I remember thinking, you know, dreadfully sad about the one who died. But I think that shock pulled a member of our family up and might have prevented it happening to her. So, you know, whereas bad things are bad, you know, it's no good pretending they're good, but things can always have helpful outcomes for others. And whether we see dreadful things happening on the news or experience them in our lives, we should look for the good, look for Christ, because Christ is there. If you listen to the news this morning, you've probably heard them talking about Sir Chris Hoy, who at the age of 48 has been given 4 years to live. You know, an Olympic gold medalist, wonderful athlete, knows he's going to die. He's got young children. His wife has aggressive MS. And yet he wasn't talking directly to this program, but he was quoted as saying, "This is an opportunity to promote goodness, to strengthen people's attitude to cancer." So there it is, you know, and the many examples. You might have heard Simon Boaz talking on the Today program a few months ago about throat cancer and it being in a wonderful place, feeling really well about dying. So death isn't necessarily the end or bad. It's natural. It's what we make of it. And the same with life. Anyway, there are many more articulate people than I who have struggled with this question, and one of them is Isaac Watts. And I commend to you the next hymn we're going to sing, which is number 16, "We Give Immortal Praise to God the Father's Love, for all our comforts here and better hopes above. He sent his own eternal Son to die for sins that all have done." So interpret it in your own way.